Hello and welcome to another new episode of the Three Bid League podcast. As always, I'm your host, Tyler, joined by Matt. We're going to start things off by talking about St. Bonaventure's big win in the A-10 title game over VCU and spend maybe just a minute or two on our NIT picks for this year. But then after that, we're going to be joined by two terrific guests from outside the A-10 world. First, Zach Junda of And the Valley Shook will help us to learn more about LSU and preview their game against St. Bonaventure. Then, after that, I'll be joined by Adam Chimeo of AddictedToQuack.com to help tell us about the Oregon Ducks and how they will match up with VCU. But we got some stuff to get to first, not just the A-10 title game, but the extracurriculars that surrounded it. And Matt, I just have to ask you the biggest question from the week. If we were to wander deep in the bowels of UD Arena right now, would we find that poor Bonaventure cameraman still locked in a headlock?
Yeah, that was pretty crazy ending to that game. All around, too, that was a physical game. You know, we had the benches clearing a little bit during, and then, yeah, afterward, some more violence on the court. So I don't know. I'm a little bit concerned for that guy. I hope he's okay. But what an amazing picture at the end of that game, too, with the Bonnies celebrating on the scorer's table. You got a couple people in the stands pointing this guy out on the court. Just a great finish, or a memorable finish to a great season, for sure.
Yeah, I started watching the end of some of these conference championship games to see the celebrations. This all came about after I watched Hartford just, like, tackle each other on Saturday morning. And I got to say, I think the Bonnies had the best celebration of anybody, and one that was potentially dangerous. Security had to step in and remind them that they were not supposed to go into the stands. But, you know, shameless plug here. I don't know if we retweeted it or not, but Chucky Maggio over at Pick and Splinters put up a great article after the game and talked to a lot of players about the emotions that went into the celebration. And I know a lot of the guys, Jaron Holmes specifically comes to mind, this winning this game really, really meant a lot to them. And it's great to see. And, you know, that's one of the best things about mid-major basketball. None of these guys or very few of them are going to the NBA. And so for them, this is the pinnacle of their basketball lives, and winning this game, even though it didn't mean whether or not they were making the tournament, it meant so much to them, and you could see how much it meant to the Bonnies.
Yeah, that's a really big deal. And I mean, when's the last time we saw a number one seed win the conference tournament? I mean,
8 years.
Yeah, like winning the regular season is a big deal too, but I really think, you know, going on a run at the end of the season and cutting down the nets, like, I think that's what means the most to a lot of these guys. And yeah, you could tell that was a really big deal. That's St. Bonaventure's first tournament win since, I think, 2012 they won it. So it's been a while for them. And yeah, that's huge.
So going into the actual game, A-10 tournament MVP, Asun Ashunahi, finally gets his due for something other than a defense-only award. Long, long overdue for the first team snub. 14 points, 12 rebounds, somehow only had 3 blocks in that game. I feel like the scorekeeper must have just missed something.
Well, he had a couple goaltends, you know, he had at least 3.
He was patrolling the rim with a force that is abnormal for even him. And it seemed like it was a little bit of a deterrent for VCU. No one besides Bones really had any intent on challenging him once we got into the second half.
Yeah, I mean, VCU is just, you know, early on in that game, it was clear they were going to have trouble scoring at the rim. They started hitting some threes later on, but it's just so tough. I think that's a great example of how if you're not hitting a lot of threes from the start, it's just tough to score against that defense.
Yeah, and speaking of hitting a lot of threes, you've been critical of the Bonaventure's three-point shooting, as we were reminded on the SPU Unfurled and Friends opening monologue or whatever the hell they call it. They go 8 of 19 as a team, despite the fact that Holmes was 0 for 6. Kyle Lofton goes 4 for 5. He's finally making his threes. I can't believe it. I mean, he's been excellent all year, but I feel like this might have been his best game of the season, which really says something. He was finally hitting his threes. He was his normal, excellent self-distributing, 6 assists. I don't even know where I'm going with this. Like, I was so impressed.
No, yeah, that was. I mean, I think when you take the VCU defense into account, that's St. Bonaventure's best offensive game in a while. I mean, they dropped 88 on GW, but that's not really that impressive. Scoring 74 against the Rams, that's not bad at all. And I think Kyle Lofton shooting those threes, that really could be an X factor for the Bonnies, because he's still only 25% on the year. So he hasn't, even with his recent hot streak, he still hasn't shot the ball all that well. But you're right. Like, on a day where Holmes isn't shooting the ball well, for someone else to step up is really good. And yeah, you're right. I have been critical of the Bonnies. I think ever since I said that about a month ago, they haven't missed a three. They certainly haven't had a bad shooting night since I said that. So I got to be careful what I say about St. Bonaventure from now on. I don't want to get called out again on the SB Unfurled podcast, although that was hilarious. Like, they have one of the best podcasts in the conference, and that's probably the hardest of that. Like, I knew that was coming after what I said about St. Bonaventure not being able to shoot.
Yeah, and I mean, the only reason I don't say that this was the most impressive offensive performance of the year from the Bonnies is they slowed down a bit in the last 10 minutes. And the other game where they beat VCU and just went full freaking inferno for about half of that second half was more impressive. But when you factor in the difficulty level raised by facing another top 20 KenPom defense, this was by far the most impressive game they had outside of that Riley Center win. One other thing I just want to point out for Bonaventure before we go into the Rams, and I tweeted this out, Dominic Welch was really kind of silent throughout the game, but for me, he had basically 7 minutes that kind of sealed this thing. First 5 minutes of the second half, Bones comes back in after having been in foul trouble. He's going 130 miles an hour, trying to will the offense back. And Welch threw the clamps on him. Bones really didn't get free until Welch picked up his third foul and had to come out of the game. And then late, when VCU was threatening, in a 5-possession span, Welch hits a three, gets an open layup off of a cut, and gets an open layup in transition. And those 7 points basically just shut the door.
Yeah, he was huge. And I think we'll talk about it more with VCU, but I mean, overall as a team, they did a really good job of shutting down Bones Highland, which is how you beat VCU. But I thought in particular, yeah, Welch coming up with some of those huge plays in the second half. I mean, he's always – I've always liked him as a defensive player. And I think Oshun gets a lot of the credit, deservedly, for the Bonnies' great defense. But Welch is right up there. He's a really good player.
Yeah, and both ended up having a pretty good game on paper, 21 points. He got to the line 12 times. Remember, he was scoreless at halftime and then played poorly to start the second half. He willed them back into the game. Once again, the offense outside of him really kind of struggled. But, Bones getting that third foul midway through the first half, if there's one play that killed VCU, that was probably it. And, we won't rehash the ref stuff because the VCU fans still bitter about it a few days later. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But more important than Bones picking up that third foul, I'm now left to wonder, Hassan Ward's not a good enough offensive player to play in the NBA. And I'm kind of surprised we haven't heard the Mo Alie-Cox tight end stuff. Could he just end up as a pitcher?
Hey, well, he's got to learn something. If he's going to be a pitcher, like, the number one unwritten rule in baseball, you got to aim low if that's what you're alluding to. You can't aim at the head. And I thought that when he threw that ball into the crowd, or not the crowd, but, the huddle of players, that was a little bit too high. But I don't know. He had a good arm. You're right about that.
Yeah, that was entertaining. And by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, and I say this because until probably 4 minutes after the play, I had forgotten this rule. And then actually shout out to my dad, who was the one who reminded me of it. If there's a double technical, it becomes a jump ball. That's why Bonaventure got the ball back. And Kyle Lofton was fouled shooting a three before the timeout. I forgot that too. And Bones Highland did not have one free throw. He had two. The CBS camera crew just simply neglected to show us one of them. So, you know, we had Gene Steratore on that game. I don't know why he didn't cover all this in depth, but it was a wild, wild game. Thankfully, VCU made it fun at the end. Any other takeaways, things that I've just passed over here?
The only other take I really have, you bring up Gene Steratore. I can't think of another A-10 conference game ever that had a rules official as part of the broadcast crew. That felt pretty big time. So that was pretty cool. And yeah, we needed him in that game with all those fouls getting called.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same thing, that, wow, this is big enough that we get Steratore on this game. You know, honestly, that was one of the best announcing crews we had all around all season. I always forget till March that Jim Spanarkle is actually pretty good. And, you know, after listening to some of the crap we had to hear all year, it was really a stark reminder. I would take Ian Eagle over any play-by-play man in any sport for anything. So, I mean, if we could get him and Dr. John paired up at some point, that would be my dream A-10 game. But fantastic broadcast all around. Basically the best we've had all year, save for having Dr. John and Martucci together for the pillow fight. So it's a good way to wrap up the conference season.
That was. I still miss the days of Vern Lundquist doing the A-10 championship, but he's got a, you know, we still get him for the Masters at least, so can't complain too much. But
yeah, we didn't get a slight whisper of who the hell is Jalen Shaw when he came on the court. But, you know, that seems like the last A-10 game of the year. It might not be, because this conference is dominating the very important tournament, the NIT. Four A-10 teams in the 16-team field. SLU is the overall favorite at 4-1. Slightly ahead of Ole Miss and Memphis. Davidson is at 10-1. Richmond, who we just learned will not have Grant Golden for their first game, is at 20-1. And Dayton is at 30-1, despite the fact that they're 5-1 against this field, the teams in this field this year. As we know, Dayton plays great against good competition as long as that good competition is not the VCU Rams. So with four A-10 teams in this, I feel like the pick has to be an A-10 squad. Who are you taking to hoist the NIT trophy, not in Madison Square Garden, but in Dallas?
Not Richmond. I think they're dead, especially without Grant Golden, but even with them, they're just not playing well. I think Dayton, honestly, that Memphis game, I think they can win. I think that's going to be a little revenge game for Jalen Crutcher playing his hometown team that I'm assuming didn't recruit him. So that's how he ended up here. I don't know. I think I got to go with Davidson. I've been on the bandwagon all year. I want to see Kelvin Grady. So he's like 10 points away from 2,000. I mean, I guess if they play four games and he lights it up, like, he's not going to get to 2,100, but he could get pretty close. So I think I'm going to go with the Wildcats. I also just think out of the four A-10 teams, they probably went in to the season with the like smallest tournament aspirations since they picked pretty low. So I feel like they're actually going to be playing to win. I'm not sure about like St. Louis and Richmond. They might be kind of disappointed to be here, but kind of fun to see all these A-10 teams in it. I wasn't really sure if that's something to look forward to. Glad they get to play one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of assuming this is going to be one of the most competitive NITs ever. We saw five teams drop out, so if any of these squads don't want to play, I feel like they just wouldn't be there. I think everybody's in it to win it. If you've made the trouble to go into that bubble environment, then I think you're going to bring it. For me, I really like Davidson's region. I think they got the best draw of any of these teams. They get to play an NC State team that SLU bullied early in the year and honestly looks a lot worse now than they did in that game. Then they get the winner between Colorado State and Buffalo. I think it's a pretty nice draw to the semis. Dayton's is pretty tough. SLU should be able to crush Mississippi State. Then they end up with a tough quarterfinal game, either against the Spiders, potentially with Golden back, or a pretty underrated Toledo team. For me, I mean, I'm kind of writing off Richmond if Golden's not healthy, but I'd take the Billikens as an outright pick. They're the most talented team in this field by far. I think they are truly in it to win it. Goodwin and French are going to want to end their career on the highest note that they can. In terms of odds, I love Dayton at 30-1, given that they're going to show up and try in all these games, but Memphis and then possibly an SMU team that they already lost to is going to be a really tough way to start things out. I'm going to think about throwing a little bit on the Wildcats if I can actually find this at a bettable book. Right now, all we have is a screenshot on floating around Twitter, but it's going to be really fun. I think by the time this episode airs, the Richmond Toledo game will already be over, but Davidson plays Thursday night. Dayton kicks off everything on Saturday right before Bonaventure, and then SLU on Saturday in the early evening.
Yeah, should be fun. I mean, you know, we get 6 bids total if we're counting everything. So not quite a 3-bid league in the way we wanted, but there's a lot of A-10 teams playing in the postseason. So good for all of them. And I'd like to see any one of them win it. That would be pretty cool. I don't think it's happened since GW won the NIT maybe 5 years ago, back when they were respectable.
Yeah, it's going to be entertaining. I will promise everyone right now, when one of these teams wins the NIT, we will put out a wild podcast massively over celebrating the accomplishment. So be prepared for that. We got a quadruple header of A-10 teams on Saturday. I'm excited. I'm pretty sure you're excited. And coming up, we got some great guests from outside the A-10 to help us break down those 2 NCAA tournament matchups. So stay tuned. I want to take a moment to talk about Purple Stride Pittsburgh, which this year will be a virtual nationwide event. Pancreatic cancer is the world's toughest cancer with a 5-year survival rate of just 10%. Pancreatic Cancer Action Network is determined to improve patient outcomes, but they need your support now more than ever. That's why Purple Stride Pittsburgh is going virtual this year. Join PanCan on April 17th and turn your neighborhood purple to help raise awareness and vital funds for pancreatic cancer. Learn more and register for free today at purplestride.org/Pittsburgh. That's purplestride.org/Pittsburgh. All right, now we're going to talk about the LSU-St. Bonaventure game on Saturday, joined by a very special guest from the SEC, Zach Junda from And the Valley Shook. Thanks for joining us, Zach.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited that we have a tournament again after such a long, long year of not having one.
Yeah, it's wonderful. We got great games coming, and honestly, I look at the slate from a complete unbiased perspective. I think this is going to be one of the 2 best games of the first round. 2 teams who probably deserved a lot better than an 8-9 matchup, but I'm sure that we've both hashed that out in our respective Twitter spheres. So let's get down to business with this matchup. One of the biggest things that I noticed just kind of doing my initial research into LSU is that stat-wise, this team is very heavy into their 4 best guys: Cameron Thomas, Trendon Watford, Darius Days, and Javonte Smart. So I think it'd probably be best to just mostly focus on those guys. And I want to start with Cameron Thomas, 5-star freshman, comes in, makes first team all SEC. And the most impressive thing to me was seeing that, with the exception of one game where he only played 4 minutes, he scored 16 points or more every time he stepped on the court. So what's been the most impressive thing that Thomas has been able to do on the court this year? What's the thing that will really be his strength going into the tournament?
Thomas is just a scoring machine. He came to LSU billed as maybe the top scorer in the 2020 or 2021-2020 recruiting cycle, and he's more than lived up to that. He's the career leader in points at Oak Hill Academy, and for those of you who even keep up with the slightest bit high school basketball. Oak Hill Academy may be the basketball program in the country. This program's produced Kevin Durant and Carmelo Anthony, and Cam Thomas scored more points than those two guys. He started off his career with a bang against a fellow A-10 opponent, or excuse me, in the second game against A-10 opponent, St. Louis. He had about 27, 29 points, and just from there hasn't really slowed down. Again, he said up but for a rolled ankle a couple minutes into an Ole Miss game, you know, he just racks off 20 points like it's nothing. The problem with Thomas, he's a volume shooter, and especially as of late, that volume and the efficiency, they don't really match up. So he's scoring 20 points, and that's great, but he's also having to take 19, 20, 21 shots. So there is an imbalance. The thing I've loved most about Thomas, I think what's going to serve him best in Indianapolis, tremendous free throw shooter. When the pressure's on, he can get to the line, and he makes his shots. He's pushing, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it's around 89%, and he's in top five in 88. He's top five among all D1 athletes or D1 basketball athletes and free throw makes and attempts. He can get to the line. He will make his shots. And I think that's going to be his best attributes at the next level, even beyond LSU, whenever he leaves, which I'm assuming will be this season, when he almost definitely becomes if not a first round pick.
Yeah. And a really impressive thing that stood out to me is all of his worst shooting games from a high volume, low output percentage, he managed to get to the line 10, 11 times every time. So is that an adjustment that you kind of see later in the game? Does he tend to realize that he's struggling and maybe start going to the hoop more, or is this more coincidence?
I don't think so. I think he just has that mentality of get to the line. He kind of plays basketball the way the NBA is starting to trend, which is threes and getting to the line. He doesn't take a whole lot of long twos, doesn't settle for pull-up baseline jumpers. He can make them, but he's either driving and getting fouled, or he's pulling up from three. He's got just crazy range, and there is it is pretty awe-inspiring when he's going, but other times when he gets into a slump, because I think he's shooting maybe like in the high 20s now from three, maybe 30%. He's taking he can take shots from around midcourt. Like he took like three or four against Alabama from beyond three, beyond the NBA three, right around the SEC logo. He made like two or three of them. It was awesome. But when he missed the one, you're like, yeah, you probably don't need to be taking that shot all the time. He can make it, but he shouldn't always take it. But for whatever reason, he has that green light from the coaching staff. And it's deserved. It's definitely a deserved privilege because he can make them. Sure, I'd like him to make it a little more higher volume or more frequently, but you know, he more than makes up for it by getting to the line when that shot isn't falling.
Yeah, and he's kind of a tweener wing size, comes in at 6'4", but a pretty big 210. So I'm sure throughout the year he's been guarded by guys all across the perimeter positional spectrum. Have you seen any kind of indication that he does better or worse against a specific type of defender, maybe a smaller guy, a quicker guy, a bigger forward? Or is this just a case of maybe the freshman jitters causing some of his lesser performances?
I think he and the team as a whole struggle against these bigger, more deliberate pace teams. I have it here. LSU's lost nine games, and most more often than not, it's against teams who really slow down the tempo. You know, they lost the St. Louis game, who's 212 in tempo. They lost to Florida, 165. Kentucky's 181. Texas Tech's 316. I know St. Bonaventure got it right here in the 300. So this could be a team that gives LSU and Thomas specifically problems because of how they play. I don't want to say they lack the discipline. I think it's more, and I don't know if it's a bigger indictment to say this, they don't have a whole lot of movement. It's a lot of isolation ball, a lot of, okay, now it's my turn, but you don't see a lot of cuts. You don't see a lot of pick and roll action. You don't see a lot of ball screens, and that gets frustrating because these games are going to slow down starting this weekend. And again, they don't struggle in the half court because again, they are so good offensively, but LSU's going to want to get up and down in transition, and I fear St. Bonaventure is not going to allow that, and that's going to cause them to struggle.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of looking at the matchup, this is one of the most disciplined teams that I've ever seen in St. Bonaventure over on the other side, and it's something that I know we've talked about on this pod all season long. It's their ability to shut down teams when they try to play unsmart basketball, so Maybe that evens the playing field a little bit, despite LSU's both size and pure talent advantage. But you mentioned something in your nice write-up after LSU lost to Alabama in the SEC title game, a game that I'm sure most of us probably didn't see since it was running concurrently with Bonaventure playing VCU. But you noted that the Tigers have really been struggling on the boards, and while they're positive for the year, if you take out three non-con games and a dominant performance over Vanderbilt out of the stats, then they have gotten beat on the boards throughout the year. That's one of Bonaventure's strengths. Is that something that worries you going into the game?
Yeah, I've said in every – I haven't got to dissect every box score like I wish I could. I just didn't have the time. But almost every time I did one – the first thing I looked at was rebounding margin, and I've been telling our readers, guys, this is going to be their death. This is what's going to cause them to get beat. They can't, especially on the offensive end. They don't get those second chance opportunities. They don't have that true elite rebounder. Darius Days is a good rebounder, but more of a tweener with his size. What they really need when they made their Sweet 16 run 2 years ago, and they had Cavell Bigby-Williams, that if he wasn't 7 feet, he was at least 6'11". But he was a grad transfer from Oregon. He was perfect for what Wade wanted to do offensively. He could just clean up everything. Even if they had Emmett Williams, who declared at the end of this last season as a stretch five, that'd be so much better. But they don't have that. Sharif O'Neal, Shaquille's son, you were hoping he could be the guy to do that, but he just hasn't really provided that because of injury. They brought in his name's Brian Penn Johnson from Washington as a transfer, but he left the program almost immediately. So you're playing these Watford, Trenton Watford, who's great, a second team All-SEC, played the game of his life Sunday against Alabama. He's more of a four, and honestly, probably a bigger three. But you have him trying to play as a center. Darius Days is a stretch three trying to play center. It just doesn't work. And I'm going to butcher his name, but Bonaventure's senior center, Oshunahi.
You're closer than half the TV announcers who are paid to know his name.
I'm worried because I was looking at it. I didn't jot every single thing down, but I see that Bonaventure rebounds like 30% of offensive misses. That could be 37 against LSU because just they don't have the size.
So interestingly enough, and something that probably doesn't show up when you're kind of glancing around at the box score, Bonaventure, who plays a massively undersized power forward in the 6'5 Jalen Attaway, he is probably their best offensive rebounder. Oshunahi does his damage on the defensive glass where he just vacuums up everything. But it's Attaway just kind of sneaking past guys and making beelines to the basket that tends to be more of an issue for opponents.
Yeah, and that, so they don't have that one guy who can – and maybe what they could do is have Days play, like really hang around the three and kind of draw Oshun out and open up things for – Javante Smart drives or for Cameron Thomas attacking the rim, but they really haven't. I don't know if you can install that in just a few days of practice, but with having to travel to Indianapolis on such a short turnaround from Nashville, Wade even said either today or yesterday, he's glad they got the Saturday game because if they would have had to play on Friday with that short of a turnaround, they were going to be real fatigued having played three straight nights, especially – That Arkansas game was a 10th. That Alabama game was right down to the buzzer. LSU, they also – they play five guys, but it's really more they get their production from four. They don't have any bench depth to really speak of. Josh LeBlanc, he could factor into the game. He is about 6'10", 6'11", but he's so bad with, like, get into foul trouble, he might play himself out of the game too quickly. And even if he does stay in the game, he's not the best free throw shooter. And I fear Bonaventure might exploit that.
So you mentioned the team might be tired, and I just wanted to throw in this one fun fact that I dug up from Sunday. While both teams were simultaneously playing their championship games, LSU's bench played 18 minutes, Bonaventure's bench played 17. So LSU starters will actually be the tiniest bit fresher. But I want to go back to a guy that you mentioned in that, Javonte Smart, the key to the perimeter for this team, led the team in assists, was the best three-point shooter at 42%. He's a guy that I, more than anyone else in this team, remember watching from years ago. And I honestly thought he graduated like last season or maybe even earlier than that, but he's somehow just a junior. What should we expect from him? Because he's a fantastic point guard and a big one at that. That could be a problem for the Bonnies.
Yeah, not only is he the team's leading three-point shooter, he's the leader in the conference as a whole, the entire SEC. Smart has started to come around as of late. What's fascinating about Smart, he's a point guard in name, but he plays more as a two. So LSU has this problem where you essentially have two shooting guards instead of a true point guard. That's if a lack of rebounding is their biggest flaw, having that real true distributor, Javonte Smart's not quite that. I mean, I believe against Alabama, they only had like 8 assists, and that's just kind of par for course for the season. They very rarely get to double digit assists, and it irks me, but that's not, they just don't play that way. Smart is more of a score first, kind of a Derrick Rose is really big praise because Derrick Rose is an MVP, but you get what I'm trying to say, more of a scorer before a passer, but he can pull it up from three. He's a good free throw shooter in his own right. And he lives for the moment. He could be that guy. He hit, I believe, 4 threes in the second half against Alabama. He kind of, every time they needed a big basket, he's the one that gets it. Not Thomas, not Trainer Wofford. It's usually Javonte Smart making hay from distance. And he likes to talk. And I remember after the Ole Miss game, whoever was calling the game asked Trent and Wofford, you guys kind of like being the bad boys of the conference because, you know, the Will Wade stuff and all that. And they do. And Smart really embodies that. And it's fitting because he was the one tied up most closely with all the Wade shenanigans. We know guard play is the factor to going deep into the tournaments. That's why LSU was able to go so far the last time there was one, because Tremont Waters was a great scorer and facilitator. Smart's a great scorer, but I don't know if he's really that good enough, if he's that good of a facilitator, and he's going to have to be against a Bonaventure team.
So the other two guys, Trendon Watford, Darius Days, the key big men. You mentioned Watford goes for 30 in the SEC championship game. And really just kind of looking around, it seemed to me like it was kind of a given this year that if Trendon Watford played poorly in a bad game, LSU was probably going to lose. But between him and Darius Days, who's the bigger X factor for this game? Who's the more important guy to get the job done?
Oh, it's Days. There's this stat, like LSU's like 18-1 or 17-1 when Days goes for 10 or more. Maybe they're even undefeated. Days, his problem, he also can get into foul trouble pretty quickly. So if he's not scoring, and it just drives LSU fans crazy for whatever reason, his points are inversely tied with his fouls. When he's scoring, he's not fouling. When he's not scoring, he's also fouling. You know, the biggest one I point to in the second Arkansas game, with the game they lost at in Fayetteville, Days had 0 points. You know, against Alabama, he had two. He made up for it with 12 rebounds, but Dave has to be that stretch. He's not a 3-and-D wing because no one on this team really plays defense, but he gives that element. He hits at a pretty good rate for a guy his size. He can be it. I don't think he could really hang on an NBA roster, but if he does, it'll be because he can step back and make that three. Watford, I love, but Days is that glue guy. Days is the most important player to this LSU team.
So you mentioned that nobody really plays D on this team. No. And nope. So I guess that kind of destroys one of my future questions. And I guess I'll ask this as a two-parter then. Number one, biggest possession of the game, who do you trust most to be able to get a stop on defense? And how are we looking in terms of rim protection for the Tigers? Are they able to really provide teams resistance?
If there's anyone on the floor that would want, to answer your first part, I would want a true freshman guard, Eric Gaines. He's probably going to be running LSU's offense next season, assuming Javonte Smart leaves. Gaines, he just tries so hard, and it just stands out. And it got to a point, I believe against Ole Miss and Arkansas, where Wade couldn't afford to keep Gaines off the floor. It got to a point where his crunch five, his finishing five, was Thomas, Smart, Gaines, Watford, and Darius Days. I'm really high on Eric Gaines. He's not there as a scorer yet, but he doesn't have to be, not with four other legit scorers on this team. He's real thin and lanky, but he's got these long limbs, these long arms, active hands. He's quick. He could really disrupt Bonaventure passing lanes. He did that against Arkansas. He did that against Ole Miss. He kind of shrunk in the moment against Alabama, didn't get a whole lot of run. But if I had to trust anyone to get a stop on the defensive end, it's got to be Gaines. As for a rim protector, they don't have one. And I hate saying it, but it's true. Maybe Watford, if he's engaged and he's playing like he was Sunday against Alabama, but that's not Days's game. Really, it's not Watford's game either. LeBlanc is more likely to foul than get a stop. They just don't have that guy.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of makes sense that the Tigers struggle a bit on defense. You see them as an 8 seed, and then you go look at their KenPom numbers on offense, just mind-blowingly great on that side of the floor, the fifth best offense in all of college basketball. They're going up against a top 20 defense in St. Bonaventure. As I mentioned earlier in the week, there's only two matchups where that's true in this first round. Ironically, they're both of those defenses are the A-10 teams, LSU and Bonaventure, and then Oregon going up against VCU. But as we kind of begin to close this out, what's the biggest X factor for you in this game? What's the matchup? Who's the guy, et cetera, that you feel like has to go LSU's way for the Tigers to win?
Days has to get anywhere from 12 to 17 points for LSU to win. You can pretty much book Cam Thomas for 20 points. It's going to be a question of how many shots does it take to get there. If he has to take, you know, including free throws, 23 shots, 24 shots, LSU might be in trouble. If he can stay in that 17, 18 shot area and get his 22, 23 points, I think LSU would come out on top. And I'm also, if LSU wins, I'd encourage readers, listeners to look at the box score and look at Eric Gaines' plus minus. Because if it's a plus 8, plus 9, that's a great sign because, again, he's not going to really score. LSU gets virtually no production from his bench. They had zero against Alabama. Like, literally, you and I had as many points as the bench Sunday. But if he can get, you know, three rebounds and a steal, and really swing those 7 to 9 minutes he's on the floor, especially in the second half, because again, he's showing he belongs on the floor in these crunch minutes. That's the trio that's going to push LSU over the hump. You kind of know what you're going to get from Jabonte Smart. You kind of know what you're going to get from Trenton Watford. That's their foundation. It's a great foundation. Most teams would kill to have the foundation of those two guys. But what can those three of Thomas, Days, and Smart do to push LSU over? Or do they literally shoot themselves out of the tournament by going 7 for 21 and 3 points? And both, and that's what's so scary about LSU. Both are equally likely.
Yeah, and just having watched the Bonnies all season, one of the biggest things that stands out is if you cannot stop Kyle Lofton and Jaron Holmes from just dribbling their way into the paint, it means a lot of trouble for your defense. And so I will certainly have my eye out to see if Eric Gaines plays a lot early. Seems to me, the way you're talking, he's going to have to be the guy to guard Lofton.
And I hate that. What year is Lofton? He's a junior, correct?
Bonaventure's entire starting lineup is a junior.
And I just hate that you're tasking an 18-year-old who was in high school this time last year, or taking classes via Zoom this time last year, to stop a 21-year-old who has tournament experience, who has these kind of bigger moments under his belt. Gaines doesn't have that just yet. Well, he got a taste of it over the weekend, but experience matters in March. And while LSU has some experience, Devontae Smart still from that Sweet 16 team, Darius Day still from that Sweet 16 team, asking your best defensive player to be a true freshman, that's dicey.
Yeah, and so for me, the biggest matchup that I'm going to be looking for, because I'm focused on who's going to win the battle between the LSU offense and the Bonaventure defense, strength on strength. And as I look at the size profile of the Tigers, I don't see any way that someone besides Dominic Welch is going to be tasked with Cam Thomas. I thought he had his best defensive stretch of the whole year. First 5 minutes of the second half against A-10 player of the year, Bones Highland, really shut him down, and him getting his third foul was how VCU got back in the game. But I want to see if he can not necessarily stop Thomas, because it seems to me he is a man that cannot be stopped, but force him into some bad shots, make him play an inefficient game. And then just from an entertainment perspective, I want to watch Darius Days battle with Jalen Attaway. Two undersized power forwards, both good for different reasons. Days because of his strength, Attaway because of his crazy leaping ability. I just think from a basketball standpoint, it's going to be that power forward showdown is going to be super, super fun.
LSU, to their credit, they have played some pretty elite defensive teams, and they've scored their points. Alabama is number two in defensive KenPom. They scored 75 and 79 points, and they damn near beat Alabama on Sunday. They had Texas Tech beat in the Big 12 SEC championship before just melting down in tremendous fashion. They gave St. Louis fits. Now, it is concerning that all four of those examples I cited, LSU lost all four of those games, but I'm not worried if LSU can get their points. The biggest question I have for LSU is how efficient can they do it, and they're not going to play the level of defense that the Bonnies are going to play. They're just not. But can they just make those three or four stops, just a couple of empty possessions over a 5-minute stretch at the end? And they have done that at times. And it's so agonizing when they can go, like against Texas A&M to start SEC play, they held A&M without a field goal for like the final 7 minutes. And, you're looking at this going, why can't this be more consistent? And it's baffling, really, because you think back to Will Wade and VCU, you just associate defense with VCU, and it just, for whatever reason, hasn't followed any of his teams at LSU.
Yeah, and if you want to see an example of how LSU has performed against a defense as good or better than the Bonnies, they've played against three teams that are better on KenPom on that end of the court, and I mean, two of them were literally this weekend. They put up 78 on Arkansas, got enough stops to win that game, put up 79 on Alabama, lost by one. So we know they're going to find a way to get buckets against great teams.
I'm never going to get over that Alabama game. I don't know if you watched it. It just rimmed in and out that last shot. That's just such a kick in the groin kind of loss. But I think it's the best thing for them because that Alabama team, they're the highest two seed, correct? That's like a number five team in, across all college basketball. They've taken down some of the best. You know, they beat Arkansas, who I believe is number 10 in the poll. Gave Alabama fits, gave Texas Tech fits. They've got some giant killer in them. We were talking before we started. I think LSU matches up well against this current iteration of Michigan, but the bigger question is, can they get to Michigan and get past St. Bonaventure? And frankly, I have my doubts. I have my concerns that they're not going to get past round one.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it before we started recording, and I think we both feel that whoever can come out of this battle royale is going to have a great, great shot to beat Michigan. You know, I mean, I personally, every year I take a one seed to lose in the second round. It happens about 3 out of 4 times. Personally, I think that this is the spot for it. If you're taking any bracket advice from me, I'd look out for it. But before I ask you my final question, do you have any other lingering thoughts about this game that you just feel like you got to get off your chest?
How this 3-point thing that I'm looking at St. Bonnie, am I looking at this right? They're accurate, but they don't take a lot. What's the deal with that?
This is, we've had this discussion on our show probably every episode for like the last 6 weeks now. Basically, Bonaventure was afraid to shoot the 3-ball until about mid-February, when they then had 2 really hot performances shooting wise against Davidson, and then got super giddy for about the next 5 games, which hurt them real bad twice. And then in the A-10 final, they kind of went back to their bread and butter. For me, Bonaventure's at their best when they're just trying to get the ball into the high post and make plays from there. The 3-point shooting is basically what kind of happens when that doesn't work.
Okay, because LSU's, they can be had on the 3-point line too. So when I saw that they're, I have it written somewhere. I can't find it. But when I saw how accurate their 3-point shooting is, that made me groan when I saw it. But when I saw the volume, I was like, okay, well, maybe they just, for whatever reason, don't utilize this strength of theirs. Like I'm looking at it, Dominic Welch shoots 40%, but only takes about 6 attempts. You know, also, I'm curious, this ball movement I'm looking at, their top 25 in assist to turnover ratio, it looks like they don't beat themselves, do they?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is one of the, like I said earlier, this is one of the most disciplined teams I've ever watched, at least in the A-10. Kyle Lofton, especially, just he takes care of the ball about as well as you possibly can.
Yeah, that makes me worried because, yeah, I don't want to say that LSU is undisciplined, but just when they make some of these turnovers and just play so with so much reckless abandon, it loses games more often than wins them. And I'm worried, especially because I believe 9 seeds have like a better than 50-50 record against 8 seeds. I'm worried that LSU is going to fall in this round.
Yeah, and the one thing that I will say, it just kind of going back to your earlier mention of the 3-point shooting, it's been kind of a mystery how aggressive the Bonnies are going to be at the line the first 10 minutes or so of the game. But one thing that we have seen is if they're ice cold or if any specific shooter, especially Welch, is red hot, then they're going to go with the numbers. If Welch is feeling it, you better believe that they're going to find a way to continue to get him open the rest of the game. So this is not a team that goes away from what's working or sticks with what's not working just simply on a whim.
And then I guess if we don't want to spoil it, but if you had to make a prediction Saturday, which way are you leaning?
So I got to say, I mean, I've felt for weeks like Bonaventure would beat any 7 through 10 seed in the country, except for maybe Loyola, who I also feel is ridiculously underrated, but that's a conversation for a different day. This was a tougher matchup than I expected. I was hoping that they would play like Oklahoma or Missouri, who I thought that they would just pound into the ground. I think it's going to be a great game. I think that in the end, the Bonaventure discipline and defense wins out in a very close one.
Yeah, I can see that too. I know I run an LSU site, I'm supposed to pump LSU, Sunshine, and all that stuff. I fear it'll be another game like Alabama where it's like it's the best game of the weekend. It's a classic. Twitter's all talking about it. And LSU's on the wrong side of it. I could see them losing like, 77-71, something like that. They're there till the very end, but the lack of a true pass first point guard, the lack of movement on offense, and just being unable to keep Bonaventure off the boards, I think gets LSU bounced in the first round in Indianapolis.
I will say, if you tell me that it's going to take 77 points to win this game, then in that case, I think I would probably pick the Tigers.
Really?
I think that Bonaventure is going to – now, the reason I feel good about picking St. Bonaventure is I feel like they're going to be able to keep the pace lower, maybe hold LSU to something in the 65 to 68 type range. But if this is going to turn into a high 70 shootout like the SEC title game, that – all of a sudden is going to start to favor LSU from a pace standpoint.
And LSU's going to have to get it to the 70s. When you said 65, like that was a death toll when I heard that. I don't have their results in front of me, but I can't imagine they have any game where they score 60-1. I feel like it had to have been a loss every single time. So I think 65 is like the magic number.
Here real quick. I think they beat 70 in every win this season. So, yeah, you are certainly right there. But before we wrap things up, I got to ask, because A10 Twitter will be disappointed in me if I don't. Has it helped at all for this team this year? No, you know, I guess the SEC, they have more fans in the stands than the A10 does, but certainly not a full house anywhere. Has it helped the Tigers at all that Will Wade hasn't had to listen to any student sections making FBI chants this season?
I mean, I don't think it's hurt. I mean, I don't think it's really helped either. They've dealt with it for close to going on 3 years now. Javonte Smart's always heard it since it all came out a couple of marches ago. Every time he shoots a free throw. I live in Nashville. I made the drive over last year when LSU opened against Tennessee in Knoxville. That was pretty hectic, and they were going after Wade, but you know they beat Tennessee that game. I don't think it really fazes them anymore. I think they feed off of it. Like we were saying earlier, they kind of embrace being those villains, the bad boys of, if not the SEC, maybe like all of Division I basketball. And I think that's good. I think college basketball needs a couple of black hats, and LSU kind of thrives in that role.
Well, you know, I think the VCU fans are going to be bummed out to hear that. They certainly enjoy rooting against Will Wade at this point, and they certainly get a kick out of everything that has to do with the college basketball law breaking. But Zach, you know, I just discovered you here in the last few days. You do some really nice work. Where can people find you? Where can they look for your work if they're trying to do some final day research on the Tigers?
Yeah, I'm going to do a big deep dive on the Bonnies from an LSU perspective. I'm over at And the Valley Shook. We publish stuff multiple times a day, every day. It's baseball season for us. Spring football started for us as well. We should have some stuff on that coming up soon. Me personally, I'm kind of our hoops person. You can find me at my name's Zachary Junda. We should I'm going to tease it. I want to have this Cam Thomas deep dive coming up before Saturday's tip off, because it kind of ties in with the volume. And like, my thesis is, you know, he's LSU's best scorer, but is that a good thing right now? Like, should he be taking all these shots? Because the stats don't quite back that up, but how do you justify not telling a lottery pick, hey, don't shoot so much? And that's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and a great write-up on the SEC championship game. Some good stuff over on that site. Like I said, just discovered it myself. It is worth the time, especially for Bonnies fans who are trying to get in their research. Zach Junda, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on A10.
All right, now to talk about the VCU-Oregon game and get some perspective from a man out on the West Coast following the Ducks, we're joined by Adam Chimeo of AddictedToQuack.com. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Hey, man, I couldn't be more excited. I mean, I'm just stoked for March Madness. It's actually going to happen this season, knock on wood. I couldn't be more stoked to talk to you, man.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. And you know what? It's a 7-10 game, so that means everybody gets to be optimistic no matter what side they're on. This is certainly going to be a good matchup. 9:57 p.m. start out here on the heat. So thank God it's on Saturday. Everyone can stay up late to enjoy it. But
yeah, we got that Pac-12 after dark coming your way, it seems like.
that's a perfect way to describe it. Yeah, you guys will get it at dinner time. We'll all be half asleep by the end of the second half. So to start things off, this Oregon team, one of the biggest things that struck me trying to dive into them, it's a very egalitarian team, and correct me if I'm wrong, but 5 starters all averaging at least 10 points a game. If I'm correct, I believe that the only 2 other teams in the tournament that can say that are UCLA and St. Bonaventure. But even beyond that, 2 guys tied for the same amount of rebounds per game, 2 guys tied for the same number of total assists for the season. It seems like a team where everyone really contributes. All 5 starters are 6'6" on the dot. But I want to start here with Chris Duarte. He's the guy that really intrigues me the most. I always kind of thought of him as the de facto point guard of this team. I'm not sure if he really is, but can you tell me, what should we be looking out for with this guy?
Well, Chris Duarte, even when he's not putting up the big numbers, he does do such a fantastic job, like, getting the offense really flowing through him, though I believe Will Richardson's really more in that role. But really, it's his defense that's really been making this Duck team a lot more dominant late in the season anyways. I mean, we can talk about the way the Pac-12 tournament went. That wasn't so dominant, but or at least for the Ducks. But Chris Duarte, I really think it's his defensive energy that's fed this whole team. And, you know, obviously we're down Peyton Pritchard, and we were robbed seeing Peyton Pritchard, what he would have done in March, because he was our team last season. And Duarte actually 2 years ago, I do believe, missed the tournament because he got injured just before. So this really feels like, you know, I wouldn't say he's quite playing at that Pritchard level, but I mean, he's looking pretty dang good there. Like, he's looking pretty similar. Actually, playing a very similar role that Pritchard played in this. And it's actually a pretty familiar role in the Dana Altman scheme, as in just like really choking up on guys, getting those steals, keeping the pace up. And he's had a tendency, especially in big games this season, where the first half, he hasn't been having that touch in the first half. In the second half, though, he's been hitting very clutch shots, and I'm just excited to see what he's actually going to be able to do once the competition is I believe this is going to be a very competitive game. I'll get right to that. I think you guys match up pretty well with us.
Yeah, I think we would both agree on that. But the thing that really I'm most curious about with Duarte, you mentioned the defense, first team all Pac-12 defensive team. So really, in this system, like I mentioned, all 5 starters 6'6", so gives you a ton of flexibility. What type of player is Duarte really best at shutting down? Are we talking big guys? Are we talking wings? Are we talking ball handlers?
I would say wings and ball handlers, the Achilles heel of our team right now is definitely, if you've got a talented big man, we've had a hard time defending them, to really shutting them down, which, I mean, not to look ahead, I'm sure your fans are, or you know, Rams fans are doing the same thing, but should one team emerge victorious, you got to go against Luke Garza, and that is worrying a lot of Duck fans. Like, I have a feeling if you look at a lot of Duck brackets, that's kind of where the Ducks, like, even on their homer brackets are getting kicked off. But smaller teams that are more defensive-minded, we have been, I would say, matching up with them better, especially because we had some really talented big men at the beginning of the season. Unfortunately, Nefali Dante got injured really early on. And so we have not had the patented Dana Altman shot blocker, which our best teams, I mean, we were going to the Final Four. Unfortunately, we were down Chris Boucher, but we had Jordan Bell as well. And that was a crucial part of that run. We do not have a Jordan Bell. Dana Altman, what's made him so amazing is that he's been able to pick up the pieces and get something going. Sometimes out of, like, pretty disappointing Duck rosters, he still gets them going around March. However, that is clearly the Achilles heel. A talented big man scares us, I will say that.
Yeah, I mean, while VCU's big guys are certainly no slouches on offense, that's not exactly where they get the source of their power. So something that certainly worries me in the matchup from the Rams' perspective, you'd say that Duarte's best at guarding wings. Well, Bones Highland may be a point guard, but he certainly is a bigger and more intimidating wing. And I'm definitely worried that Duarte may be the kind of guy to shut him down.
Well, and I could tell you, we're looking at your defense, and even though we're so good at, you know, like, I'd say three people are really our offense, I would say, which, of course, Figueroa, Duarte, and then Eugene Omorui, which, despite what Bill Walton say, he's not from Eugene. He says that line over and over. But, yeah, he's not from Eugene. But those three players are our offense. But it really does seem like the Rams may be able to take away one, maybe two of them. And then I'm not, you know, usually we've been able to rely on someone pulling out those big games. But that loss to the Beavers really kind of has us stepping back and reassessing what we got here. So I'm not putting money on this next game, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, Oregon got the top seed in the Pac-12 tournament, rampaged through their first game, then lost to the arch-rival Oregon State in the semifinals, of course, leading the Beavers to steal a bid, which eventually we found out ended up being Louisville's bid, so now we can be happy about it.
But yeah, at least someone's happy.
You mentioned the three guys who kind of run this offense, so I'm going to ask you about Eugene. I want you to start off by reminding me once again how to say his name, because I was going to be way off on it. But then just kind of tell me what should we be watching for with him from the offensive perspective? Where does he make his bones? I guess that's a bad pun, but where does he get his buckets from?
Bones is your guy, I believe. Okay, so, Eugene, so Omorui. That's the way I've heard it all season. So Omorui. Hopefully we're hearing that name a lot during the game, because that means things are going good for the Ducks. Really what's impressed me is just truly his physical presence. Like, this guy is, I would say, the best athlete on Oregon's roster. And so when he can combine that with hitting threes, then he's the full package. It's truly just been, you know, even though he hasn't consistently had huge games, he is very regularly scoring, like, even from day one when he was playing, consistently scoring in the double figures. And I think it's just his hustle, his motor, and this is a pretty thin team. I mean, we love our four go-to starters, and then we have just recently Eric Williams Jr. has been stepping in there. But we're not looking to go to our bench much. So Eugene Omoruyi has played big minutes throughout the entire season. One of the only players who hasn't missed time outside of our COVID breaks. So he's just been as crucial as possible. And it's pretty amazing that this is his first year in the system. And he's been able, by about the midway point of the season, he was just clicked in like any other amazing Altman guard. He's been very fun to watch.
Yeah, he came in from Rutgers, right?
He played Rutgers. And I know he has a very inspirational story about coming from his actual homeland, wanting to help everyone that lives there. He sent a lot of, I remember it was his birthday, and said he had a big fundraiser just to help the village where he came from. But he also played in Canada, I do believe, for prep school. And but played for Rutgers for a good long. And it's just, he's just one of many Dana Altman transfers that he's able to just scrounge together at the last minute and get a quality team coming to March. That really has been the staple ever since Dana Altman has been here, is treating that transfer market to the best you can. It's been amazing.
Yeah, another key transfer in the starting lineup, but we'll hold off on him for a moment. I want to save him. I want to save Eric Williams to the end in case I get emotional at losing him still. But the Ducks come in shooting the three ball at 38%. That's good for ninth among the 68 teams in the tournament. Pretty impressive. So I guess one of the keys, certainly the fact that all five starters shoot the ball pretty well, all over 35% from deep. But other than that, what's the key to generating so many good looks for the Ducks?
Well, I think it's a constantly moving offense. It really is, you know, spreading it out, moving the ball as quick as you can, and then being able, like you said, to hit the three from anywhere, anybody on the court. That really is what's getting the offense. When it is humming, that's why it's doing so well. I still really think the defense is what's been really the motor behind this whole team. So all the turnovers we're creating and all the just fast break points, that's really been our bread and butter. And that's where you'll see like the athleticism of a lot of these guys, like Figueroa has been a lot of fun to watch in that same regard. And, but I will say when we're not hitting the threes, which is rare, considering we have so many people that can, on the nights we can't, it has been some tough Pac-12 late West Coast basketball to watch. And and you know, sometimes that can just happen for reasons. So it really has been amazing that there's been so many able to hit the three, and that has been why we've been able to survive not having a big dominant player, though Chandler Lawson has been stepping up a bit, and that will be crucial.
Yeah, and I mean, without going too deep into the big matchups of the game quite yet, but that's something that I'm really got my eye on. You mentioned the Ducks have struggled when they don't hit the threes. VCU 30.5% three-point defense. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned this earlier in the pod. There's only two matchups in the first round of this tournament that pit a top 20 KenPom offense against the top 20 KenPom defense. And that's the two A-10 teams up against LSU and Oregon, respectively. So just like with the LSU Bonaventure game, I think a lot of this game is going to come down to Oregon's offense against VCU's defense, strength on strength.
Yeah.
Although, the way you're talking, it seems to me like you might be a little bit more confident in the Ducks' D than I think we all are in the Rams' offense.
Yeah, I really am. You know, it's one of those things where, I mean, KenPom's great, and I think the numbers are always there. But it does seem like I think the defense is still is almost the strong point of this team. I mean, hitting the threes has been crucial and has helped everything flow better. But we are at our best when we're holding teams around 60 points or under, which has been impressive to see actually against a Pac-12, which isn't as bad as some other years. And that's about as positive I can usually get about the Pac-12 athletics in general. But yeah, I've been impressed with how we've gone against some of the better teams in the Pac-12. Though, again, like you see against USC, who they do have some very talented players, like Evan Mobley especially was fun to watch. They just dominated us on our own court when we were already going on a good run later in the season. So I do think there are some flaws that could be exposed during March. I'm hoping we can get a run before they're truly exposed, I suppose.
Yeah, and I mean, USC is a team that feeds through their ginormous, soon-to-be NBA big man, Evan Mobley. For me, I see the team as with the best perimeter offense outside of the Ducks in the Pac-12 as being Colorado. And yeah, the last time that Oregon took them on, they pulled out a 60-56 win at home. One of the biggest things to me in that game that stands out, McKinley Wright goes for just 10 points, of course, all Pac-12, borderline All-American for them. You know, I don't need you to go too deep here. I'm sure that the details of the season have kind of gone into a haze, but do you remember anything kind of specific that the Ducks did to shut down Wright? And I guess really this is leads to more of an overarching question of from a formation standpoint, what would we expect to see from the Ducks against a team like VCU who is so guard reliant for their scoring?
Yeah, well, when everything's working right on defense, which in that game it certainly did, you know, it feels a lot like a standard 2-3, but there's so much more motion. There's so much more, you know, so often a team will want to like find their spot to kind of counteract that. But there's a lot more movement, a lot more kind of man-to-man emphasis in there. And so that has worked really well for us in the past, but that requires a lot of communication. And that's why it's been so impressive that Dana Altman's been able to do this with transfers year after year, and why it's taken them a little while to get better. But when there isn't that communication for whatever reason, and it may be because what the offense is throwing at them, or it may just be because nerves, you can clearly see the defense not making the switch they need to, and then just a very easy bucket. And in that game, Colorado just wasn't really able to do it. McKinley Wright, if I remember correctly, it was also just a surprisingly off game for him. It was one of those where you're like, oh, well, you know, the defense did a good job, but also I think something was up with McKinley Wright there or something. He has been fun to watch, but the Colorado team has also been surprising at times, especially that final Pac-12 tournament game was, I mean, I'm sure it was a bit too late for you. It was probably going on at like 11 p.m. or something like that. But it was a strange one against the Beavers too. And yeah, that Colorado team's actually been really surprising. They've been fun to watch. No one will want to root for them though, obviously. I mean, I believe they're going against Georgetown, right? And I am... I want to see them at least make a little Cinderella run, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the Dayton fans have certainly been out on them for 4 years. We're still mad that McKinley Wright does not understand that it is the University of Dayton and not Dayton University. I guess a quick background for you, not deeply involved in the A-10, McKinley Wright was set to go to Dayton until Archie Miller got the Indiana job. And in his decommitment letter, just put the wrong school name, and he has never been forgiven for it.
Well, I hope he didn't do it on purpose. That's all I have to say.
We will never know. But back to the defense, you mentioned the emphasis on the man-to-man defense, the good switches. And to me, that sounds like the kind of defense that, if executed correctly, is the thing that can beat VCU. Certainly something that I'm worried about, as you say it. You know, we've seen throughout the year, if you can play great man-on-man defense against Bones Highland, and very, very few people have done it, but those who've succeeded at it have really just caused the VCU offense to go to a full sputter. So on the flip side, VCU is going to set screens, and if if the Ducks aren't switching well, then I'd put my money on Bones having another 30-point night.
Yeah, and that may very well happen. I mean, our last outing, and they should be given a little bit of credit in that to make up for a lot of missed games due to COVID, they did have to play a bunch of games in a very short amount of time. Like, I do believe it was like within a week, they had to play their final four conference games, which ended with them beating Oregon State, actually, 80-67 in Corvallis. And then, you know, shortly after, there was the tournament. So I will say that did affect it a little bit. I'm feeling a lot more confident now that Dana Altman is going to have some time to actually get his ducks in a row. But I use that pun all the time. But so I am feeling like we're going to get a good showing from Oregon just because Dana Altman has proven to have worse teams than the one we have this season very well prepared to peak at this moment. So I would think VCU will need to be on top of their game to keep it competitive, but I'm certainly not 100% expecting a duck win, a big duck victory or anything like that. Cause I mean, that defense has been, it's been legit, clearly.
So you mentioned earlier that they rely heavily on the starting lineup, and the stats certainly show that. But for a guy like me who's just coming on here, I see the five starters. All those numbers look great. Mm-hmm. Who is the guy that I might be overlooking? If I told you that a bench player for the Ducks was going to come out and have a huge game that led them to victory, who would you say is probably the most likely guy?
That is a good question, because there really aren't a lot of people where I'd be expecting that. I mean, I will say Chandler Lawson. He's 6'8", and we have a freshman who actually reclassified to play earlier, and he's played very few minutes. So I'm not sure if we're going to see Frank Kepnong. That would be very surprising. But Chandler Lawson, as our big man, has been forced into the role. And he did look good against Arizona State. Arizona State, that is not a tournament team, that being said. My guess would be, it would definitely be off the bench. I don't think we'd be seeing a surprise start from him. Amari Hardy, 6'2", he's a senior. And he's not starting purely because, I mean, there are four better players easily that are taking his spot and playing a role that he would play. So it really would be Amari Hardy. Other than that, like, maybe you'll be hearing from Jalen Terry, but this seems just so unlikely because this team has been five people and then two off the bench, and it is mainly just to earn some, just to spell some of the starters, it really feels like. I mean, they have had some success. Some players have had some success off the bench, mainly Hardy and Terry and Lawson, but it hasn't been enough that I'm confident against a quality team that they're earning those minutes per se. So my guess would be Hardy. But if someone's going to lead us to the win dominantly, it's probably going to be one of our main three there.
So before we close out the player discussion with Eric Williams here, am I overlooking anything with LJ Figueroa or Will Richardson, two guys that we really just haven't discussed so far? I know you've mentioned both of them quickly in passing, but anything important that maybe I might be overlooking and kind of relegating them to just simply being your third and fourth guys?
No, I actually have been really impressed with them. And I mean, Will Richardson would have a lot even better numbers had he not been injured right before the season. I believe it was his thumb he had to have surgery on, I believe. And he missed, I think, the first 10 weeks. And so he was very, very crucial because he actually is playing, like, he is the true point guard, I would say, of this team. And was training under Peyton Pritchard. And I do believe the only player with tournament experience on this Ducks roster, if I remember correctly. So Will Richardson's actually very crucial. And I say we have three dominant scorers in, you know, Omoruyi, Figueroa, and Duarte. But Richardson, that's only because Richardson has needed time to, like, acclimate himself to it. But he really is showing up. For all I know, he could be the leading scorer throughout the tournament. He really has been doing very well and has been getting a lot hotter from three recently, though ignore the Oregon State game. So I am very pleased with Will Richardson. I think he's going to show up big. And then I got to say, Eldrick Figueroa is very surprising to me because I wouldn't think that I definitely didn't think he was going to be such a dominant starter as he's become. But when things are going right for that guy, they're going really well. And another huge problem these Ducks are having is in the rebound games on the boards. There's been games where we have been just beaten pretty badly with it, and Figueroa is crucial in that battle. He's not especially tall or anything. He's 6'6", just like everyone else on this team, you know, 6'6" and lengthy. But Dana Altman has been looking to him to try to make a bigger difference in the battle of the boards, and he has shown up with that. I'm hoping he can do it with some regularity. But really, one of the reasons why the fans have been liking him a lot is because he's been hitting not just threes, but like clutch threes and like crucial moments and showing no hesitation for that. So there is a pretty good possibility that we will be seeing like big time threes from LJ Figueroa. I've been pleased with him this season.
Yeah, and you mentioned the rebounding being a problem too. VCU slightly negative on the season in terms of rebounding, but one thing we have seen from them is that in matchups that are very favorable to them on the boards, they can dominate. So maybe something else to look out for there. But, you know,
And I would say the Ducks have at times been, you know, you're looking at teams where they should be winning that battle and they're still losing. So it really is. It's been pretty bad Achilles heel for this Ducks team.
So one of the guys tied for the team lead in rebounding, of course, it always seems crazy when a guy who's basically profiles as a small forward leads you in rebounding, but with this kind of no center team, it's not that ridiculous. And for anyone who watched him at Duquesne, it's certainly not ridiculous at all. And I'm of course talking about Eric Williams Jr. So two-part question here. Number one, is there any way that you would let Duquesne have him back? And then number two, just really, because I think a lot of the people who listen to this podcast have seen plenty of Williams at this point. They know what he's about. But what has he done for Oregon this year that's really been the most impressive?
Well, what he's done first of all, you can we're gracious here. You can have him back, and we're confident enough in Altman that he'll somehow pull in a new one. So, you know, it may be something where you careful what you wish for, because then we may be taking someone else from someone other team. But he's been very impressive, just that he's gelled pretty quickly, and that we've just – he's just becoming that fifth person, and it seems like he absolutely is a starter now. Even if we are playing a bigger team in which you would think maybe we want to put in our taller Chandler Lawson or someone like that, it is clear he is a part of this team's chemistry right now, and that alone I think is pretty impressive. And you know, Dana Altman is giving it to the people who deserve it the most. And actually, he has showed up in some pretty competitive games. I would say, especially down the stretch, or when we were down for a little while, we were down Duarte, and then we were also down Richardson. And we've just been down so many starters. He has been such a consistent thing for this team. I think that's what's impressed me so much, is that it's just yet again someone who's somehow able to pick all of this up, let alone in this season with all the other stuff that's going on. He's just adapted so well. And you could see why he was a hot commodity and why he has fans. Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that he's certainly improved from Duquesne is you call him consistent. That would have been the last word that we would have used for him in those days. The stats are down a little bit across the board. Points per game down by about four. That's certainly not surprising. He's just playing with a more talented roster now. Absolutely. To me, the only thing that's alarming is 6.1 rebounds a game is actually down from his sophomore year, which was already down from his freshman year. That's something I'll be really looking out for in this game. Not necessarily even for the matchup, but just as someone who's watched him play so much, is he playing with the same level of bounce? And it'll be, I doubt that they'll actually guard each other that much, but it'll be fun. It'll be fun to see him and Hassan Ward both go for the same rebound. That's a, that's a duel in the air that we never got to see at Duquesne. And I want to watch that.
And basically that could kind of determine the game, you know, the eagerness to get the rebound for the Ducks, that energy is really going to determine how far they go in any game coming up. So, yeah, and so it really will be just kind of who wants it more and who can, like, stay in the mentality of what their program has instilled in them. And, I mean, I can tell you, Duck fans are not sleeping on the VCU Rams. There is not this, like, well, what are we going to do about Garza? Like, there's not even a whole lot of looking ahead, I will say. Yeah, you got the full attention of the fan base.
They should not be. And, you know, you just segued perfectly into my final question here. What, in your mind, what is the biggest matchup for this game?
You know, I will say after, you know, it seems like offensively the Rams, like, you got Bones, like, he's scoring and he has been dominant. And I bet you he's going to get his in this game. And I think he'll have a great game and he'll have plenty of highlights. I think it'll really come down to, will there be a second or third person that can show up? I know there's that, I believe there's a junior Williams. He seems to be the second man who's stepping up the most. Because I think they'll let, you know, yeah, I think that'll really be what it comes down to. And then not only that, but if you can just take away, you're going to have to take away maybe two of Oregon's best scorers. I really think that's going to be it too. It's just who can kind of like plug the holes up of the other person's defense the most, you know? I think it'll come down to just 1,000 paper cuts is the way you'd lose to Oregon. And then the way Oregon may lose is just, it actually may possibly be just one star player takes over the game and the Ducks just cannot hit their threes and can't keep up with it. And that's the game. Yeah, honestly, these teams are similar in a couple of ways that'll make it interesting. And whoever goes on next, I'm excited to see if a true one-man show like Iowa will be enough to just power their way through, or if, you know, there's enough of a team effort to take them down. I'm excited.
So, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you talk about VCU's lack of a second scorer, and I'm wondering if maybe you've been quietly listening to this podcast all year. That's been a theme week after week with the Rams. To me, that's certainly a big thing, but even more so than Baldwin and Williams, because you have certainly made me confident in Oregon's perimeter D. I think that those two guys may not have the best games. And so for me, one of the biggest keys, can one of the VCU big men, either Stockard or Ward, make a big offensive impact? And for them, big means 12 points and two or three offensive boards. Can one of those guys step up and really take advantage of the fact that they're going to be guarded by smaller guys basically the whole game? So that'll be the matchup I'm looking for.
Yeah, if they play just kind of like fearless, I mean, like it's March Madness, and are really going out there, I mean, they may be surprised how easy it is to score against the Ducks team, because that really is their, you know, I've said it before, but that is their Achilles heel, a talented big man. So they just got to go out there and play like a talented big man.
Yeah, I mean, VCU's got a few big guys I would certainly call talented, but none of them have been offensively dominant this year. So it's a big question mark on both sides.
Yeah, exactly. I'm stoked. I couldn't be happier. Yeah. I mean, just for the whole thing, on just to sit on my couch all day and watch some basketball, really.
Game 32 of 32 in the first round. It should be exciting enough to keep us all awake. But before I let you go, Adam, where can anybody find your work if they want to learn a little bit more about the Ducks, if they're doing scouting past this pod, or who knows, maybe they enjoy watching the game so much that they decide to start following Oregon in the future?
Oh, sure. I mean, I've definitely had teams like that, you know, teams that have beaten my team or we've beaten them, then I'm kind of a fan of them. Like for a long time, it seemed like the Ducks were just kind of, we're just tied with Wisconsin, both in football and basketball. We're just always playing each other. And it seems like the fan base is actually kind of like each other. But anyways, they can find me. The website Addicted to Quack is where I am the managing editor over at SB Nation. And then we have a weekly podcast, the Quack 12 podcast. And we actually even do live streams, kind of live watch parties during these games, just because, you know, a lot of people are watching this alone on their couch. So this will feel like you got a couple of buds hanging out. And it's been fun, actually, unless we lose and then we got to sit and live stream a loss, you know, but it's still a lot of fun. Addicted to Quack and Quack 12 Podcast. That's where you can find me. And then at Quack 12 Podcast, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, some great stuff over on Addicted to Quack. People should definitely go check it out. But thank you for joining us. I don't know.
Of course, man. Yeah, 3-bid league, man. I'm all about it. And I'm hoping next March Madness we get another A-10 Pac-12 matchup and we can talk some more.
Absolutely. This was a great time. And, you know, if Oregon does happen to get past VCU, I know at least the Dayton fans will root for him because we still haven't gotten over Luka Garza complaining about player of the year last year.
There you go. Yeah. That's even the better kind of fan base, is the fan base that hops on just to throw hate at some other player that has nothing to do with it. That's the kind I want.
Spite is always fun. That's a great way to end this thing. And a great wrap up to this interview. Thank you.
Nice talking to you, man.
A big thank you to our guests, Zach Junda of And the Valley Shook and Adam Chimeo of Addicted to Quack. And thank you to all of you who've listened to this pod and listened to us all season. We are just hitting the final pinnacle of the year. 4 games on Saturday, 2 in the NIT, 2 in the NCAA tournament. And I gotta say, this is certainly the most optimistic I've been at any point in the history of the pod, that we will see an A-10 team move on to the second round of the NCAA tournament. Not fully confident as to which team it will be, but between the two of them, VCU and St. Bonaventure both got good matchups. I am hopeful that at least one of them will come home with the victory. So thank you to all of you who've listened to this. If you enjoy the pod, be sure to give us 5 stars on iTunes, leave us a review on there. And if you have any comments, if there's anything that you've enjoyed that you want us to continue to do, or anything that you think we can be doing better, absolutely do not be afraid to reach out. You can send us a message on Twitter at @3BidLeaguePod, or send us an email, number3bidleague@gmail.com. Everyone enjoy the weekend. The NCAA tournament is back, and be sure to stay safe out there.